Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to the Psychology Forum of the Commonwealth Club. My name is Patrick O'Reilly. I'm a clinical psychologist. I'm actually a psychologist at San Quentin Prison, which is how I got to meet Lieutenant Robinson. He's a preeminent authority on prison gangs. As you probably know from the media, the prison gang culture permeates the prison system in the United States. It also has enormous influence in the community. It's worthwhile knowing about this phenomenon. And Lieutenant Robinson has spoken on this subject many times. He's a delightful speaker, so please welcome Lieutenant Robinson. Thank you.
Welcome. How are you doing today? Hey, all right. I'm Lieutenant Robinson, as my friend Patrick O'Reilly stated. I'm the public information officer currently at San Quentin State Prison. And so what does that mean? Well, that means that I primarily deal with the media now, relative to anything and everything you can think about, whether it's Scott Peterson or Richard Allen Davis or some of those more notable people at San Quentin and some of the just germane things that happen inside of our prison walls. I deal with that every day in my primary position now. However, I began in the department about 12 and a half years ago as an officer right out of college. Had no desire or design to get into law enforcement or anything like that. I actually went to school to be an engineer. However, I was working my way through school, and I had relatives who had worked for the department for a number of years prior to my entering into the department. And they said, you know, you can make much more money working for the department than you can being a security guard and working your way through school. And so my thought was, as a starving college student, more money sounded good to me. My relatives had already paved the way for me in that they had the aptitude to go inside of a prison and deal with this environment that's completely disconnected from society as a whole. And so I was confident that I could do it. Well, because of state budget crisis, kind of similar to what we are in now, it took me 2.5 years to go through the background process. And 4 days after I graduated from college with an engineering degree, I get a letter in the mail from the Department of Corrections saying, hey, we have invited you to join the Correctional Officers Academy. And given that I didn't have anything else to do, I said, you know, I'll try this temporarily and I'll do this until something better comes along. However, 2 weeks after actually beginning inside of an institution, and San Quentin was my first institution and the only institution that I've ever been at, I found a love for the work, and I've remained there ever since. And so I began there as an officer in uniform. I worked as an officer for almost 4 years, promoted to sergeant, and now I'm a lieutenant. I've been a lieutenant for the past 4 years now. 10.5 years of my career, and I've been in the department 12 and a half years as a whole, 10.5 years have been on death row as an officer, a sergeant, and a lieutenant. Well, just kind of a little more background on me. During that last series of executions at San Quentin, when we executed Tookie Williams, when we executed Clarence Ray Allen, I was a lieutenant of death row. And so I have an intimate ideal about our death row policies and procedures as a whole. But as kind of as a sidebar, because of many of the issues I dealt with at San Quentin relative to some of the prison gangs that I dealt with on a regular everyday basis, I got an interest. I found an interest. I wanted to know more about these people who were, in essence, assaulting our staff there at San Quentin. About 2000, 2001, the Mexican Mafia at San Quentin declared war against staff. And so what does it mean to have a prison gang declare war against staff? It means, for lack of a better term, it's on and cracking every day. Every day our staff would walk down the tier, and they would come off the tier after feeding the guys or whatever the case may be, because guys on death row don't go to a dining hall and eat in masses or in large groups. They eat in their cells. We give them trays inside their cells. However, when my staff would come off the tier, they would report to me that Sarge on 3 North of the Adjustment Center, which is where we house the worst of the worst of our gang members at San Quentin, are at 1 South or wherever in the building it was, they were sensing something. And pretty much their sensing what they sensed every day would come to fruition. And what they were sensing was this aroma somewhere on the tier. It was an aroma that once you smell it, you know what it is. What these guys were doing, they were storing urine and feces in cartons somewhere inside their cells. And as our staff would walk down the tier, these guys would throw the urine and feces in their faces. And that was pretty much an everyday type of occurrence there at San Quentin Adjustment Center with the Mexican Mafia. So we decided to protect our staff at San Quentin. And how did we protect our staff at San Quentin? We gave them face masks. We gave them face masks to protect themselves as they walked down the tier. Well, in a sense, that worked, because when a guy throws urine and feces on you, it rolls off your face shield and onto your uniform, and many of our officers would continue working after those type of assaults, because they didn't want to give those guys in the building an opportunity to chase them outside of the building. They didn't. However, the inmates began to change the way they began assaulting our staff, which is they began firing darts at us. And to say that you're firing darts at staff isn't necessarily demonstrative enough. They were firing darts at our staff made out of little crude instruments, staples, or any pieces of metal that they could get. And many of them were fired with enough velocity that they were actually penetrating these motorcycle helmet shields that we gave our staff to protect themselves from gassings. And so, as a young supervisor there in that unit, I knew I had to get an understanding of these individuals who I dealt with every day and my staff dealt with every day. Well, kind of going more in my background, I grew up in East Oakland. And the neighborhood I grew up in East Oakland is over in the flatlands, kind of outside of, just outside of the Coliseum, and a really bad gang-infested area. And so I had my own experiences with gangs as a whole. However, I took one route, pretty much based upon the love that my parents gave to me and just various other opportunities that I had. However, my friends didn't necessarily end up as Mexican Mafia members. They ended up as gang members in some sense, whether it's in prison or whether it's on the streets or whatever the case may be, they're affiliated with some type of gang. But I decided to learn how these things perpetuated, how a group of two or three individuals inside of prisons, how were they able to proliferate into these super gangs that we have today, which truly we all deal with in our culture every day, whether it's our children who are receiving tattoos and they don't know why they're getting tattoos, but it's kind of that culture that have come out of our prisons, and it all began with these prison gangs. Well, the gang that's known as the Gang of Gangs, which is the Mexican Mafia, they begin back in the late, '50s, early '60s. And they primarily began as a group of guys inside the prisons who had been gang members on the streets. However, because they were in prison and they didn't have those gang member protection from the streets inside of the prisons, they decided to form gangs inside of our prisons to protect each other. I guess, in a sense, it was kind of a noble cause to protect your own group from what was perceived as racial hatred by or these attacks by other groups inside of prisons. Now, this picture are on the screen here is a picture of a group of guys, and these aren't gang members. These are individuals who were in a movie, they were in a movie about the Mexican Mafia, the beginnings of the Mexican Mafia, which is a movie called American Me. It has James Edward Olmos and several other actors here. However, on the next page are the real gang members. This is the beginnings. Are these individuals here are truly how the Mexican Mafia began? And again, kind of an old gang member. As the screen says, in 1956, the gang phenomenon began. And there are many prison gangs inside of prisons. I think I need to back up. Because in prisons, gangs that you and I identify with on the streets, such as the Bloods and the Crips or Skinheads or whatever the case may be, inside of prisons, we don't consider those groups gangs. They're not. They're considered disruptive groups to us. They formed outside of prisons with the ideal of controlling what happens in their own neighborhood, protecting each other inside of their own neighborhoods against these factions which may have been across a train track or around the corner. Those are what we consider disruptive groups. However, inside of prisons, there were small individuals or a small number of individuals, kind of like in the prior prompt, who formed to organize these different groups who were scattered about throughout the prisons. Well, again, back in 1956, at the Duval Correctional Institute in Tracy, which is truly here in our backyard, these group of individuals, Guerrero Buff, Luis Flores, or Luis J. Flores, Cheyenne Rodolfo Cadena, Topo Benjamin Peters, and other East Los Angeles gang members formed or joined through their street gangs and formed what's known as the Mexican Mafia, or the La M.E. The La M.E., and as we move on further in this presentation here, you'll see symbols that are tattooed on individuals, such as M, or numbers such as 13, or whatever the case may be, which have true meanings that you and I, who are just walking the streets, may not have an ideal of what it is. As I said earlier, there are kids who have tattoos, and they mean certain things, but it means certain things to them. It isn't necessarily reflective of a gang. But these individuals here, they have certain symbols which identify their belongings to true gangs inside, true prison gangs, true people who are. Their whole design and desire in life is to commit crimes inside of prisons and outside of our prison walls. Well, the Black Hand. One of the symbols of the Mexican Mafia is the Black Hand. Historically, this was picked up from a gang prior to or before the beginnings of the Mexican Mafia. There were a group of Irish immigrants who used the Black Hand as a symbol of for their groups that they had organized back on the East Coast. Well, the Mexican Mafia here in the state of California adopted this symbol as their symbol that they would utilize to symbolize those people who were dedicated Mexican Mafia members. Again, the ME originally saw itself as protecting their group or their race from other races inside of the prison walls. However, a group of five or six individuals, and their numbers are small in total in the Department of Corrections today. There are only 188 recognized Mexican Mafia members throughout the department. However, if I could have some water, please. Can I get some water? However, back in the beginnings when the Mexican Mafia formed, they saw that they were strong based upon their ruthlessness and their abilities to intimidate other individuals inside of our prisons based upon their ruthlessness. Thank you, sir. Their concept changed, and that concept changed from being a group that protected other groups inside of the, or protected their group inside of prisons, to a group that began perpetrating crimes, mostly amongst their own people inside the prisons, but also against those other groups that they were supposedly protecting themselves from. And well, let's back up. And so what are valuable commodities inside of prisons? Valuable commodities inside of prisons are narcotics. How do inmates get narcotics inside of prisons? Well, primarily through visiting. And how do you pass a bag of marijuana or heroin or whatever the case may be to an inmate or inside of a prison? Well, we in the California Department of Corrections just don't let people walk up with these illegal substances and process them into our visiting room with the knowledge that they have them. Normally, they utilize their friends, who are primarily women, to secrete them inside of their underwear or inside of their bodies or whatever the case may be. When they're inside the visiting room, they give it to the inmate, who normally swallows it himself or secretes it somewhere on his person, and then they get it inside of our institutions. So inside of our, once the narcotic is inside of our institution, then its value is increased. What is a $5 bag of weed here in society, or marijuana here in society, in prison, it's 10 times that amount. And how people are able to afford that, who knows? homosexual activity. During this time, when the ME formalized inside of prisons, people who were inside of prisons who decided to do their own time were seen as weak by the inmate population just because of their personality, because they exhibited some type of fear or whatever the case may be, they were forced into prostitution. And so that's where your homosexual activity derived from inside of our institutional walls. And those prostitutes or those men who became prostitutes were sold out to the various inmates throughout the population in order to enrich the Mexican mafia. Gambling, and inmates gamble on anything, football or every and anything that you and I would go to Las Vegas or whatever the case may be, or online to gamble on, they do. However, it's not, if you want to do your own time, it's not highly recommended that you participate in those type of activities. Because by gambling, again, guys inside of prisons who make next to nothing, the average salary inside of our prisons now are anywhere from 30 cents to 95 cents an hour. That's what our inmates who have jobs make inside of prisons. So if you're gambling, normally gamblers lose. And as gamblers lose, they incur these debts. And by incurring these debts, eventually they get to the point where they can't pay. And what happens? Either they have to pay by some type of way, which is one of the ways that the Mexican mafia or other gangs manipulate people into homosexual activities or whatever the case may be, into prostitution to pay off their debts. Extortion and taxes. As a gang member, you just can't be a gang member in the Mexican mafia and leave the prison and go and live your life. You have to pay taxes to the hierarchy. And so what happens is individuals, as they return back into society, whatever money they earn illegally or legally, in some sense, it makes it back inside of our prison walls because they send it back to the hierarchy in those prison gangs to further their development. Well, again, this is the Mexican mafia in their beginnings. Many of those guys, because of the sentencing structure prior and even today, they return back to society. Currently, in the Department of Corrections. 80% of the people who are in the department return back to society. Well, when these individuals were incarcerated for various crimes, whether it was murder or whatever their commitment offenses were, they returned to society. And as they returned to society, they had parties and went to the christenings of their children or whatever the case may be. However, they continued criminal activities. And this is kind of another picture of many of the founders of the Mexican Mafia. Well, again, the Mexican Mafia formed to protect their ethnic group was inside the prison walls. Well, in that, and that initial noble cause, again, they went out and they began committing crimes against their own people inside of prisons. And primarily the crimes that they committed against their own people inside of prisons were individuals who were from a different geographical region from themselves. Those individuals who were from L.A. or East L.A., they were known as being charismatic, as being city slickers, whereas the people who they normally victimized inside of our prisons were those people who arrived at our institutions from rural areas. They were farm workers. Thus, those individuals who were more charismatic and city slickers, in a sense, they ended up becoming alliances with the Mexican Mafia. And there was another group that was out there. Those farmers had to formalize a group themselves of Hispanic inmates, had to formalize a group themselves to protect themselves. Thus, we had another group of Hispanic inmates form a gang inside of our prisons, and that group ended up being called the Nuestra Familia. And again, there were numerous wars that took place inside of our institutions between these two groups. However, in the mid-60s, there was an attempt by one of the early founders of the Mexican Mafia to bring the Hispanic population together, the Hispanic incarcerated inmate population together. Thus, Cheyenne Cadena, who I mentioned before, one guy was able to put out the word to his counterparts to let's forge an allegiance with this group that we've been battling with, that we've been victimizing with for a number of years. There's strength in numbers. Well, for a while, there was a small, lightweight truce that took place, and it began at San Quentin State Prison. However, as it was a fragile truce, and a small, simple incident inside the walls of San Quentin truly brought about the division between those groups today. And that incident is called, we identify it as the Shoe War at San Quentin, and the inmate population identified as a Shoe War. Essentially what happened was there were two individuals, one individual who was a Mexican Mafia member and one individual who was a Nuestra Familia member or an NF member from Northern California, who were housed together in the same cell. And for those of you who know the sizes of cells, cells are very small. Cells are 4 feet wide by 9 feet deep. And those two individuals, because of the truce, were able to live in relative harmony inside of that small, confined environment. However, one day in 1968, one of the individuals, well, let me back up. Inside of our prisons, inmates are allowed to own items that the state does not give them, whether their family send them shoes or nice coats, but just things to, you know, kind of bridge the gap between the inside and the outside, and things that are very, very valuable to inmates. However, one of the guys, or the guy who was a Nuestra Familia member, received a pair of shoes, a pair of simple Florsheim shoes, and he probably shined them up, and it was something that he cherished and probably only utilized when he went to visiting on the weekends. However, one day he came back to his cell, and his shoes were missing. And who was the first person that he accused of taking his shoes? Was his cellmate. And his belief was that his cellmate took the shoes and sold them to other inmates throughout the population. Thus, a simple dispute over shoes have blew up from essentially 40 years ago into an all-out war throughout our institutions and throughout society between two groups who are essentially cousins. Well, this explains the Cheyenne-Cadena incident that he attempted that reconciliation between the ME and the Nuestra Familia. And he wasn't necessarily at San Quentin. He began to foster a secondary truce between those groups in 1972. And because of his word and because of the authority that he had as the leader of the Mexican Mafia, he was able to, his truce hail until he actually left our prisons. Mr. Cheyenne-Cadena paroled, and he was only out of our prisons for 3 months. However, in that three-month time span that he was outside of our prison, outside of our institutions, when he returned back into our prisons, the war between the North and the South had began all over. Well, in 72, when Cheyenne-Cadena was housed at Chino, again, he tried to institute a truce between those groups because it was fragile and the truce fell apart because the time that he was outside the prison walls, his reputation fell. Thus, when he returned to prison and he put out that word again, many individuals inside of his own gang who no longer regard him as being the supreme leader of that group disobeyed his orders. So one day when he stepped outside of his cell at Chino State Prison, the Nuestra Familia, the gang that he had essentially tried to foster a truce with, ended up murdering him there at the facility because his word was no good. He wasn't able to follow up on his word. These are just puncture wounds of Mr. Cadena. He was actually stabbed 50 times and thrown off of a tier at Chino for about three stories high. For many of you who may have saw American Me, that's the last scene in that movie in which he is tossed off the tier after he is stabbed. Initially, it was believed that his own gang members, people who were part of the Mexican Mafia, had perpetrated this crime against him. But later insight now lead us to believe that it was actually that gang that he had tried to foster that truce with, the Nuestra Familia, who, because he wasn't able to follow through on his word, did him in. Well, how did these gangs proliferate outside of our prison walls? And I think that's the question that all of us have. How did these gangs proliferate outside the walls? Well, one was these guys paroled, and they returned back into our society. And when they return back into society, they don't return necessarily new men with new desires to do different things. They return with orders from the gangs themselves to foster crime and to promote and recruit and to grow these organizations outside of our prison walls. Well, one of those efforts was to infiltrate and subvert federally funded narcotics programs within the community. So the government's efforts to cut down drugs within our society, those prison gang members who in a sense, were credible because, you know, they talked the talk and walked the walk, and if they were truly sincere, it seemed like they could have reached out to the communities and truly averted many of the crimes and that took place because of the narcotics trade. However, because their hearts weren't true, they ended up utilizing those funds for their own purposes, which was to proliferate their gangs. It was just one way they utilized our government to grow themselves. Prison picture of Mr. Cadena and the Mexican Mafia as a whole. These gentlemen here, Robert Robot Salas, was actually an individual I spoke about at San Quentin who was in the shoe war. He was actually the cellmate of that new Usher Familia member who was accused of stealing those shoes. However, after years of being involved inside of the Mexican Mafia and being a true member, and it's believed that he called hits our murders outside of our prison walls, he changed his life. And as you see him here, he's now a minister with, I can't think of that group now, Victory Outreach, there it is. And those are also former Mexican Mafia members. Now again, the death of Rodolfo Cadena touched off a massive bloodbath that is yet to end. Truly inside the walls of San Quentin and throughout all of our institutions throughout the state, there have been hundreds and hundreds of murders by these gang members who their primary way of fostering and growing their gangs is through fear and intimidation. And so how do you truly intimidate someone? By letting them know that you are willing and able to take their lives. Thus, the killings continue today. Well, Joseph Morgan, who is not Hispanic, is the only member who is not Hispanic to be named as a leader of the Mexican Mafia. And he was a leader of the Mexican Mafia for well over 20 years. Another prison picture. Looked like a Great America photo, huh? And as with many of the photos you'll see up here, you'll see the guys in their youth and you'll see them at their end. It's pretty much how they all end up. You'll see them as young, strong, vibrant men who could have done anything in their lives. However, they essentially end up dying in prison of really horrible deaths. Well, now we're to my friends. This photo here was taken at San Quentin State Prison. And the first individual in that photo is Ronnie Ayala, who, if you look on the stand-up over on the side, is the leader of the Mexican Mafia at San Quentin State Prison. If you look on the stand-up over there, and I know it's small, many of you will have to look at it after the presentation, there are only essentially 60 of these guys in our institution at San Quentin. However, San Quentin houses over 5,200 individuals there on an everyday basis. However, this small number of individuals are the most ruthless and feared and vilified group of individuals within our walls. Essentially, everybody you see over there on that board, they don't walk outside and hang out freely like regular inmates do in pictures or whatever the case may be. They're all handcuffed inside their cells before they leave their cells. A number of them, after we handcuff them, we make them get on their knees and we place leg irons on them because they're still able to assault staff and each other in handcuffs. And through those control measures of keeping these guys isolated and our most secure setting, and they aren't allowed phone calls, their visits with their attorneys are behind glass, they have truly no close human contact with any other individual in society or in our institutions, period. They are the most feared group inside of our institution. Many days when you walk into San Quentin at about 8:30, 9 o'clock in the morning, you'll hear what's known as cadence, or what we call cadence. And what you'll hear is you'll hear a group of individuals, and it reverberates throughout the facility, saying uno, dos, tres. And they'll go one, and uno, dos, tres, and two. And what they're doing is they're doing what we call burpees. It's an exercise. Now, in your mind, you would imagine that these guys are sitting next to each other, just like you and I are, and it's a military formation where they're right next to each other, and you would envision that it's a show of strength in their numbers because they're really loud and boisterous. However, they're all in individual cages on our exercise yard, and these cages are 9 by 12, 9 feet wide by 12 feet in length. And inside those cages, you have these individuals who are truly separated from each other, pronouncing this cadence as loud as they can every day. Well, what's the purpose of that cadence? What's the purpose of yelling and stomping and what's the purpose of it? One is unity. There is no human contact. I don't even say it's that. They're not necessarily interested in the human contact. What they're interested in is demonstrating to the rest of the population that they have numbers, that they are willing to violate our rules inside of our prison walls. We don't allow them to do that. Every time they get together and they call cadence in group, we essentially what we do is we write them up and we discipline them for it. However, it means nothing to them. It means nothing to them because it's a show of strength. It shows that they truly have no, they don't care about the authority of the prisons. They don't care about anyone else's rules or anything like that. All they care about is whoever is the top man at that time and whatever his order is, and it's a show of strength. That's exactly what it is. And it intimidates. It's intimidating to some staff and to the rest of the inmate population there who hear these guys who are truly defying everything. It's a show of defiance. Oops. And again, Topol Peters. He took over after Peg Leg Morgan, who died in the mid-90s. Topo died in the late 90s. However, as you see, that typically happens to all of our gang members there inside of our prisons. These are some of your current Mexican mafia leaders throughout the state of California. They now rule by a council. And they don't necessarily have one supreme leader. They have a council of guys who, although they aren't connected at the same prison or they aren't allowed to write each other or make phone calls, they get word to each other, whether it be through sending notes through other gang members or whether word of mouth and people transferring to other facilities throughout the state, they get word to each other and they get word out of those facilities to perpetrate crimes truly throughout the state and outside our walls. Yes, ma'am. No, go ahead. Exactly. Like if you look on this board here, what we have is you have 68 guys that we've identified as being gang members or Mexican Mafia associates or members at San Quentin State Prison. However, there are only 4 individuals on that board who we consider validated. Which there's a process that the department goes through in which we actively develop a criteria to establish that you are a true gang member, whether it be through association, whether it be through crimes you've committed inside and outside the walls. And it could be through confidential sources who are giving up information that you are the man. We have a criteria that we established to say that this is the guy. Well, on death row, it works a little differently. Well, because death row is only housed at San Quentin, we can't send those guys anywhere. We can't send them to any other prison throughout the state of California. However, there are a few institutions inside the state of California that are these super institutions which are designed to house gang members. Well, if you are identified prison gang member, if you are a Mexican Mafia member, if you are an Aryan Brotherhood member, if you are a Black Guerrilla Family member, and there are a few others, NLR, Nazi Lowriders. If you are a prison gang member, we get you out of our general population and we send you to these super prisons where we house all those gang members. However, there are guys inside of your prison walls who are always aspiring to be one of these guys. And so, again, as people, as word filters out of the prisons, whether it be through mail to their wives and routed a different way or phone calls or however the word is getting out, when it gets back to the institutions, because people are those, these guys are dedicated to the cause of being a Mexican Mafia member, they followed through just like they were in the military and the order was given by a general. They have no say or anything like that. If that answered your question?
Yeah,
okay. Let's see. Let's talk about some of these tattoos. These are, again, just some of the what we call shot callers, or those individuals who are the supreme commanders of the Mexican Mafia throughout the state. Pictures of some of our death row inmates at San Quentin and other individuals at the Supermax in Colorado, which is a federal prison. Again, there is no formal leadership. In the past, there were a few individuals who stood up and were identified as being the leaders of those prison gangs throughout the state. However, the Mexican Mafia now is run by a council of individuals who come together and again, they may not be housed together, they may be in various areas throughout the state, but once those words come together and they come to a conclusion, the orders are followed by the membership. Again, prison goals. Are those prison gangs, whether it be the Mexican Mafia or any of those others, their whole ideal in life is to control what happens inside of prisons. And the primary thing they want to control is currency, which is money. And currency inside of our prisons are through narcotics and some of those other things we touched on earlier relative to those criminal activities inside of our prisons. As I was speaking to someone earlier before the presentation, several of the Mexican Mafia members throughout the state have been identified as perpetrating crimes as a criminal organization. Thus, they have come under come under the Federal RICO Act, and they've been prosecuted, and many of them no longer reside within our institutions here in the state of California, but they reside at, in federal facilities throughout the nation, the primary being the Supermax in Colorado. An interesting thing, the alliances. Inside of prison, because of numbers, gangs need other gangs to operate inside of our institutional walls. Well, it's interesting enough to me that the Mexican Mafia is aligned with the Aryan Brotherhood, this group of individuals who consider themselves superior race beings and truly consider everyone else to be lower or subservient to them because of the numbers and because of their need to have a relationship with another group inside of a prison just in case they were to be attacked by a larger group inside of prison. Inside of our prisons, these groups have married together and have established alliances. Mexican Mafia's alliance, again, is with the Aryan Brotherhood and generally your white supremacist groups. The Nuestra Familia, which is more familiarized here in Northern California, are married up with your black prison gangs. And also, many of the crimes that are perpetrated through these gangs aren't necessarily perpetrated by the members themselves, that 188 that are throughout the state. It's through those other groups that are the umbrella groups. The Mexican Mafia is a big umbrella group that, if you consider yourself a Sereno, or a loosely affiliated street gang member from Southern California, when you're inside of prison, you march to the orders of the Mexican Mafia. Thus, most of the crimes, 90% of the crimes, whether it be stabbings, assaults, or whatever the case may be, are perpetrated by these soldiers who desire to become members of that big umbrella group. Interesting, right there in the middle, the eagle in the middle carrying the snake, that's actually a symbol that's on what? On the Mexican flag, right? However, the next time you look at the Mexican flag, I want you to look at the snake, because the snake is different on the Mexican flag. The snake is kind of elongated, and it's held by the foot of the eagle. However, in this case, the snake formalizes an M. Formalizes an M. M meaning for Mexican Mafia. Also, all the individuals who are allied with the Mexican Mafia, they have some symbol or whatever the case may be that signifies that that's who their allegiance is to. Whether it's two M's, the bird with the M for the snake, 13. There it is right there. As you can see, the snake is elongated on the flag. That's the symbol. However, for those individuals who are Mexican Mafia members, the form of the snake is different. It's just a subversive way, it's a subversive signal that they utilize to express who they are. Also, many of these groups identify with their Aztec culture. Thus, you'll see many symbols and shields on them symbolizing Aztec warriors, because they truly believe that they're modern-day Aztec warriors. 13, many of the individuals inside of our prison gangs are inside of the Mexican Mafia. They have the number 13 tattooed somewhere on their body, and 13 being the 13th letter of the alphabet. Which is M for Mafia. What this is here is this is ancient Aztec script. And so on many of the individuals that we see inside of our institutions, they don't have any of these other symbols other than the one with three dots at the top and the two lines symbolizing the 13. And if you look on the stand up over there, you'll actually see the individual with it tattooed on his face directly over his eye, symbolizing that he is a Mexican Mafia member. In the Department of Corrections, we desire no one to be a gang member. And so, we allow them to step away from being a gang member, and we protect them. But we make them go through a process which is called debriefing. And debriefing is pretty much giving us your entire history of exactly what you did, how do you get into the gang, who your connections are, what your criminal activities and everything that you know. After you do that, you have to pretty much what we call lay down, which is you have to have an extended period of time of no activity inside our active involvement in the gang. And we give you that opportunity by isolating you out in different institutions with other people who are just like that. This says hit list. However, if I were to have one of these kites, a kite is something that's definitely been blown up here for this presentation, but a kite is something that is about this big. And something that is in this kite in particular is probably this big and about this wide. However, all of this information you see on here was written by our gang members inside of our institutions who utilize this microscopic script to send out messages to the rest of the population, to those people who are in need to know. With the Mexican Mafia, it's very rare that we get these because they normally memorize everything, as many normally those other gangs inside of our institutions who utilize this method. But in this instance, we actually got a Mexican Mafia member who gave us a kite. And on there, as you can see, there are some people who are definitely in trouble. And so there are a group of individuals who are disciplined. And by discipline, it could be a simple slashing. It could be, you know, making you go in the yard and do extra exercises or whatever the case may be. It could be something relatively minor. Or they could identify you as the next individual to go out and to perform a hit or a criminal activity inside of our institutions. And then there's the personal hit list. And the personals are those people who are definitely no good, meaning that those are the people who have been identified as failing to live up to their oaths in some form or fashion, and they are been designated to be murdered in some form or fashion.
We don't have too much time.
Yes, sir.
Some years ago, I took a tour of San Quentin. I don't know if they still conduct those tours. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
Are transported to the prison.
Mm-hmm.
How did they get them and how did they recharge them? And two proposals. Mm-hmm. One, these Mexican Mafia prisoners, we could make a deal with Mexico that they could be cared for there at about a quarter of the cost that we would. And also, I believe we could release those that are so-called seniors over 55 or 60, where the recidivist rate would be very, very low. Comment on those two proposals.
Well, we have several doctors in the back, and they deal with our population just like I do. Age is not necessarily a determining factor relative to whether a person is capable of committing criminal activities. Again, it's no secret that many of the people who end up inside of our institutions have some type of addictions, whether it be to drugs or alcohol or whatever the case may be. And because of that, they continue to perpetrate crimes. Relative to the cell phones are, I know it doesn't necessarily sound like it, but cell phones are a big deal to us inside of our institutions. There's one incident that I'm personally familiar with, which is a few years ago when we executed Tookie Williams. There was no secret in the Department of Corrections that, or in law enforcement as a whole, that the Crips had determined that they were going to kill an officer inside of each of our institutions, that they were going to kill police on the street, given that Tookie Williams was executed. Well, for months, being the lieutenant inside of death row, I interviewed my population, everybody in the population, those people who were Crips, those people who were Bloods, those people, white, black, whatever they were. I interviewed everybody to get an idea of whether this was, we had a tangible problem at San Quentin relative to our inmate population wanting to kill somebody. And 2 weeks prior to the execution of Tookie Williams, I got the word. I got the word from a player who was actually involved in that, who was actually involved in the conspiracy to kill staff, that they were going to kill us. Well, one of the ways that we actually validated those statements, because just to run with an inmate statement isn't necessarily enough evidence for us. We actually have many investigative techniques inside the department that we utilize to validate information that we get. One being phone records. And so, luckily on death row and at San Quentin as a whole, cell phone reception inside of our institution is nil. You can't get a phone call pretty much outside the institution if you're on a cell phone. You know, we have many black areas. So cell phones aren't necessarily a problem at our institution. However, we were able to go back through those records, and any of you who've received phone calls from inmates in the past, there's a little message that interrupts your conversation that says you are being recorded. You were talking to an inmate in the California Department of Corrections, and you were being recorded. Through those recordings, we were able to go back and validate that many of Tookie Williams, those people who were his homies, those people who were part of his gang, those people who were his underlings, those people who grew up with him on death row, in a sense, that those people truly the desire to kill staff, and they had a plan to do it. Thus, we were through that and putting wires on people and getting it straight from the horse's mouth, we were able to truly avert what would have been a very, very ugly, tragic incident at San Quentin. You know, just like over in Oakland about a month ago now, there were four officers who were murdered. You know, at San Quentin, we had an incident 30 years ago where we had three officers murdered. Well, the plan that the guys on death row, those Crips over at San Quentin, had developed to kill staff, they would have killed 10 to 15 people that day, given that we hadn't got the information. So given that they had cell phones, we were in an area where cell phone reception was decent and those guys inside the unit had cell phones, we would have never got that information. Thus, I would have been one of the people who wouldn't have been standing here with you today, because I would have walked out there on that yard and they would have came out of their yards and stabbed us and stabbed us and stabbed us until they were done. And so I have definitely personal feelings relative to that. Yes. Yeah, Omar Villas. There's a street gang down in L.A., a neighborhood called the Marvias. And because they don't identify themselves as being Serranos or allegiance to the Mexican Mafia, anytime a Mexican Mafia member identifies them on the yard or the prison that they're at, pretty much they're to be disciplined, whether it is by slashing them or a discipline is a lightweight assault, whether it's slashing them or beating them up with fists or superficial puncture wounds. They're not the MS-13, no. The MS-13 is a completely different group.
Are they associated with the
MS-13? Yes, they are. Yes.
So I've got a personal question for you. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
And to me, it seems I wouldn't be able to get out of bed in the morning. I'd be so depressed. How do you, what is your hope? Where is it? Is there hope? How do you do this kind of work?
Well, you know, San Quentin is truly unique. And I know I don't have much time here, but San Quentin is truly unique in the geographical location that we're at. If I was out in Blythe or, you know, up at Pelican Bay where it's not an urban area and we don't have the resources that we have at San Quentin, then, yeah, I would probably go into work not as happy as I am. You know, I'm known as a smiling lieutenant at San Quentin because I go in happy every day. And one of the reasons why our environment is a little different, yeah, we do have our problems with gangs, but our environment is different there as a whole because we have 3,000 people here from the San Francisco Bay Area who volunteer their time to come inside the walls every day to foster some type of self-help therapy or just interact with our population and bridge the gap between the inside and the outside. Thus, you know, we have a population there of San Quentin of men who, you never, because you're in a prison, you never truly trust the individuals who are incarcerated there. But because of their attitudes that they've developed through being able to access the programming that we have there at the institution, it's not necessarily as violent as the movies would lead you to believe. And so, no, I'm not scared to enter into the walls every day. And true, also, the people who I work with, whether it be the medical staff or those officers who you work with on the line, you're truly relying upon those individuals every day. And you desire to go home, you desire for them to go home, and you do the things that are right to ensure that everyone goes home at the end of the day. And so, it's I've never worked anywhere else after I left college, but truly I work in an environment that fosters a team concept every day because you can't do it all by yourself. You have to be a part of a team. You have to be a team member in order to make it out of there, in a sense, every day. Okay. Sure. Okay. Okay. Again, more symbols, street gang symbols. As you see, Lopez, Maravilla, and a lot of the graffiti you see throughout your communities or whatever the case may be, when especially a name is attached to it. In this instance here, this is signifying that Lopez is part of Maravilla, and this is his tag, and this is his area. And throughout our communities here in Northern California, you'll see similar symbols throughout our communities, which identify who tagged that area, whether they use normally their AKAs and whatever group that they're affiliated with. This individual here, Mr. Palmer was actually murdered at San Quentin on death row by some of the individuals over there in that lineup over there. Mr. Palmer, the Mexican Mafia, they desire for their individuals to commit crimes, but there are certain crimes that are acceptable to the group. In this instance, Mr. Palmer went into a house and killed a gang member that he was assigned to kill, but then he also killed everybody else. He killed the wife, he killed the grandmother, he killed the kids, and all of that. Well, because he killed the kids, he was to be disciplined. And on our yard, this weapon here that was cut out of a metal bunk that our inmate population sleeps on with many crude instruments. They utilize dental floss. They utilize staples. They utilize paper clips to cut metal. And that edge there wasn't necessarily machined in a machine shop. It was fashioned in a cell against the side of a wall, which is concrete, and just continue to work it and work it and work it to smooth it out to get that nice sharp blade type shape there. And Mr. Palmer lost his life. These are other individuals who, throughout the department, who've been disciplined because they fell short of living up to whatever their goals were. again, just like I pointed out earlier, that Aztec script that was utilized is known as the Nahuatl, and is used by the Emmy. And because it's a language that many of the members are still developing, it's not necessarily the most reliable piece of information to decipher that we have. And so we do try to decipher those scripts, and sometimes there is tangible information on them, but it isn't necessarily the most reliable information we have because the members don't know the language themselves. In instance, this is just one way they would utilize some of their codes, and one of the ways they utilize codes is by numbers. And so they identify a letter with a number. Thus, and the reference here at the bottom, Raul Leon, who is one of the primary, or he is the primary shot caller for the Mexican Mafia in the federal prisons now, because he was caught up in the RICO Act, in order to get it by us and to let those individuals know who they desire to know, they formed a script that says 839-2251N71GIAA. If you or I looked at that, what would we do with it? I'd probably toss it because it means nothing. But to those individuals who know the script and know what it's about, they would decipher it, and it would give Raul Leon and his CDC number, which all inmates in the department have a number which we identify that individual by. Again, some of the alphabet. Some crude weapons that inmates utilize to harm each other and staff within our institutions. The toothbrushes there is pretty much an example of a pretty common weapon that we have inside of our institutions. The little, next to the yellow toothbrush, the little shank right there is actually formed from a spoon that we give them. We give them a spoon and a fork that's called a spork. It's a spoon-fork combination. Well, of course, the head of that spork has been chopped off or broken off. And again, not in a machine shop or anything like that, but just during the midnight hours, being in those confined cells, the guys are able to rub against the crevices of the floor and the wall and fashion tips that they utilize to puncture people with. Again, more weapons, weapons with handles. And any piece of metal that, for whatever reason, that the inmates are able to run across inside of our institutions can be utilized to make these things. The little great-looking thing is something that we utilize at San Quentin to protect our staff. It's called a cell shield. Essentially, we have old-fashioned cell bars like what you would witness at Alcatraz. And just like at Alcatraz, where you can stick your hands out the bars, our inmates are able to do that at San Quentin. Well, we place these little protective shields made out of this grate over those cells to prevent inmates from sticking their arms outside of cells and stabbing our staff, or utilizing instruments that they've rolled up and put little tips on to staff and inmates or each other as they're going up and down the tier. Pretty common. Knives like that aren't very common inside of our walls. Inside of our prisons, because many of the individuals who you see tattooed up like what we saw earlier, they receive those tattoos inside of our prisons. And so what they essentially do is they get a radio and a couple of batteries, tear out the inners, get a little ink from wherever they're able to gather the ink from, and essentially utilize this little crude instrument to tattoo each other and draw all of those pieces of art that they put on each other. This shows here just one way our inmates inside of our institutions hide things. Inside of a simple box of soap, and if you pull it out one way and look at it, it looks like a simple bar of soap. However, if you flip it over, there, secreted inside of it is a tattooing instrument, but they secrete weapons and many other things this way also. This is one way what we call in which they make a handle. Essentially what the inmates do is if they're inside their cells, again, if you have the old-fashioned cell bars that are like you have at Alcatraz, and someone is walking up and down the tier, your arm may not, depending on the size of the individual, your arm may not be able to stick out very far. However, if you put a handle on your weapon, it gives you more room to get that instrument out. Thus, in what only takes a matter of minutes and rolling up that paper in the fashion that this individual is doing, it creates an instrument that's hard, almost like a stick or whatever the case may be. It doesn't bend at all or whatever, and it's an effective instrument they utilize to stab people with. Just another weapon they utilize for if they don't necessarily have a spear on them, but they're in a hand-to-hand combat with you, by putting a simple staple around their knuckles or whatever the case may be, they can utilize that to punch you in the face and pull out eyes or puncture you or whatever the case may be. Again, another puncture instrument. And again, something as simple as a metal tuna can or a cigarette lighter. The guys are able to tear those things apart and utilize them to make handcuff keys, which we desire them not to have because they're able to use because it's the perfect way to effect an escape. And again, this just demonstrates some of the things they utilize to cut metal. As you say, razor blades, file clips, plastic handles, pin clips, utility blades, stingers. And when I'm saying metal, I'm not talking about little sheet metal. I'm talking about thick, substantial pieces of metal. Wrap it up. All right. And I think I am actually done.
Ladies and gentlemen, we have a few minutes. If you have a few questions, we kind of ran over, and the Commonwealth Club's actually very strict about that. I want to thank you. That was a wonderful presentation, Kenneth. Okay. Thank you so much for coming out here. And if anybody has a few questions.
Exactly. The guys who are, well, to become a prison gang member, those prison gangs don't desire to have people who are not intellectual in a sense. Thus, again, the numbers inside the Mexican Mafia are very small. We only have 188 throughout the state. And so what essentially happens is that based on a made member, someone who's already a member, will go out and based upon the reputation that you've built out throughout your time of incarceration, which is, you've committed crimes, your reputation essentially precedes you, then one of those members will come along and ask, would you like to be a member? At that point, it's up to you to decide, I want to be a Mexican Mafia member, or I want to be part of this gang or whatever. Once you say yes to that, then yeah, there is an educational process in terms of dialing you into the history of the group, getting you up on current events of who's good and who's not good, and educating you on being more criminalistic in a sense, on they're educating you on how to enhance what you're already doing. And so, yeah, they do educate you in a sense, but they're not necessarily picking out guys who don't have some type of smarts about them in the first place. Well, I don't know about the extortion money, but I do know that for several years, yeah, there were supposed hits on Edward James Olmos because it was the belief of the Mexican Mafia that he didn't portray them accurately in terms of some of that homosexual activity that was utilized in the movie. These guys identify with being strong, macho men. And so being involved in homosexual activity in a prison gang setting isn't necessarily an idealistic type of ideal that you want to put out there to the public and those individuals who you essentially are trying to recruit. You know what, there's this huge phenomenon of people as a whole who are attracted to people who are incarcerated inside of prisons. I don't know whether it's, you know, people are attracted to the bad guy or whatever the case may be, but the number one call I get at my desk every day is not necessarily from media, but it's about Scott Peterson. You know, people wanting to contact him or whatever. Relative to prison gangs, I think that the same people who, and maybe not be the same people, but in a sense the same people who would be attracted to him are people who would also be attracted to these guys inside of gangs. And so what do they get? What would a woman who's attracted to a gang member get from a guy who's locked up inside of a prison and essentially forever? Well, one, they get a sense of, one, they know where he is. That's one. Two, when you visit him, or whenever you do come see him, you know you're protected. You don't have to worry about being assaulted or anything like that. And three, there's a sense of that you're being protected because this guy is a big, bad prison gang member inside of our prisons, and he has some connections outside on the streets. So essentially, you do have a group of people who are a group of women who those things are admirable. And, yeah, they do, they are attracted to them. No, when you come to prison, you don't have to be a part of a gang. That's not what you have to do. Now, there are inmate rules and guidelines that you have to abide by. Like if you and I were friends, and we were friends our whole life, and we committed our crime together, whatever it is. When we arrived in prison, then you and I, in a sense, would no longer be friends. Although I know that you would be my brother and that you would protect me and I'd protect you, whatever the case may be, we wouldn't be allowed, because of inmate politics, to sit at the same table together in the dining hall. We wouldn't be allowed to share a similar cell or the same cell. And when we're on the yard, depending on what the politics are on the yard that day, you wouldn't be able to hang out on the yard with me. There are certain segments or sections of the yard that you could go to and be okay on. and it would be the same for me. There would be certain sections of the dining hall that you could go to, and I couldn't go there. Kind of interesting. I tell it to tourists that come into San Quentin now, is about a year ago, I had a reporter from NPR come into our prison, and she wanted to do a story on our Native Americans because we have a reservation on our grounds at San Quentin. Well, in order to go into the reservation, the guys there wanted to purify me. They wanted me to walk through smoke and do this ritualistic type stuff to go into their reservation. And I said, you know, I don't want to do that. You know, I'll let the reporter go onto the reservation herself. I could sit out at the tables and view her, ensure, you know, she didn't come in, she wasn't any harm or anything like that. And just outside that reservation were some tables. And those tables are identified by our inmate population as being for the white inmates. And so it was a Saturday, and instead of having my shirt and tie on, I had black jeans and a white T-shirt. And so I'm sitting out there, and nice sunny day on a Saturday, enjoying myself. Well, the inmate population started to come out after they ate breakfast that morning. And as they made it out there to the yard, the section again I was sitting in was a white section. And so big white guy, about 6'5", maybe about that. I don't want to pick on you, brother, but maybe about that guy. Maybe about that guy's size back there. Tattooed up and definitely not looking like a very, very nice guy. Walked over me, stood over me, and he didn't know that I was a lieutenant, and said, "Hey, man," he said, "look," he said, "I don't know whether anybody's keyed you into what goes on here and, you know, where you're supposed to be at here on the yard." He said, "but these are the white tables." And so I felt like I was transplanted back to 1954, but after I got a sense of myself, I looked up at him and I said, "yeah, man," I say, "I recognize that." And he looked flustered. Well, luckily for him, and I do want to emphasize luckily for him, somebody came and tapped him on the shoulder and said, "hey, homie, that's a lieutenant." And he scurried off. And I didn't see him anymore that day. However, if I had been an inmate, if I had been wearing blue, and I had been out there on that yard that day, but the section that the black inmates were at, they were too loud, or I just wanted to go because this area was open. Essentially, inside of our prisons, because of the culture that has been fostered by these gangs inside of our institutions, not only would harm have come to me by stepping into someone else's designated area, I could have potentially started a riot out there if I had been an inmate. That's how the racial politics that are, you know, pretty much delineated by these gangs influence how people operate inside of our prison. So, yeah, you could go inside of prison and you could not be a prison gang member and do your own thing, but there are certain things you have to do. You have to respect the code. You know, you got to sit on this, you have to shower under this shower, you have to sit in this section of the yard. There's just certain things you have to adhere to no matter who you are and what you want to do. Okay. That came about a long, long time ago, way before I entered into the Department of Corrections. It's been our policy for a number of years to house people in cells based upon their ethnic group that they belong to. However, we've been sued. You know, with many things, we've been sued. And the ideal is that, you know, if places like Mississippi and Texas and Louisiana, if they can integrate their prison environments, why can't you and the California Department of Corrections integrate your in-cell housing units? Well, our arguments are that that Texas and Louisiana and those other places, they don't have the prison gang culture that we have here within our institutions here in this state. Thus, yeah, there were some definite difficulties in those prisons when they integrated their cell housing environments, but they got over the hump. But here in California, there was an example. About 6 months ago now, we began putting out to our inmate population at San Quentin that this is what the policy is. The policy has changed, and we're not going to house people in cells based upon their race anymore. And so, and then we were supposed to roll that out at San Quentin beginning January 1st. We didn't, because the lower level institutions that they began rolling that process out at ended up facing some difficulties which have delayed our integration process at San Quentin. But there were two inmates I can think of in particular who are, one was black and one was white. They're both practicing Jews. And they feel a closeness and a brotherhood because of that, because of their religion. And they decided, you know, in order to be an example to the rest of the inmate population and to this is a guy who I believe I can get along with, I want to move in a cell with this guy. And they came to staff at San Quentin and said, this is what we want to do. I want to move into the cell with this white guy. White guy, I want to move into the cell with this black guy. Well, staff drew out the documents that we utilized to move our inmates inside of our facility in terms of reassigning their housing. And when the individuals went back to their cells, the cells that they currently resided in, to pack their belongings and to move in with each other into an open cell, the white guy was harassed by white inmates who threatened his life if he moved in with a black inmate. And the black inmate was pressured by black inmates to not move into a cell with the white guy. And those guys, I'm not going to say fearing for their life, but deciding that, you know, it was in their best interest not to move into a cell with each other, went back to our staff at San Quentin and said, you know, we don't want to be the first ones here. and that's the challenge that we face. We've done forums at San Quentin with our inmate population as a whole. And it's amazing that today in 2009, it's almost 2010, that you hear people openly asking administrative staff at San Quentin, why do I have to live in a cell or in an environment with someone of a different race than me? Why are you going to force me to sit on a toilet of someone that looks different than me? And it's something that you and I do every day in real life, but inside of prisons, because again, you know, that shower is not a black shower, it's a white shower. This area of the yard is not a black area of the yard. It's a white area or Hispanic area. You can only go here or there. It's amazing to believe or to hear that those attitudes are still very, very prevalent today.